This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen. In spite of the slightly warmer weather, we now have fog, and we still have lots of snow and ice on the ground, which is a real problem for our animal neighbors. And Pat Schlarbaum has a few words to say about that, how they cope.
Phenology is writing about nature's happenings when they occur. The first firefly of spring or the last barn swallow flock of autumn are noted in a journal for future reference and comparisons from year to year. And as Lee Searles of Marshalltown writes, phenology is the study of natural cycles in the lives of living animals and plants. Today's phenology is about a rough winter for the squirrels. The winter of 2019 is fast becoming an epic in the annals of Iowa winters. As snowfall approaches historic levels of 29-plus inches, we are reminded that there were rain, sleet, and ice storms preceding some blizzard conditions. Seeds and foodstuff for birds have been entombed in ice under a thick layer of snow. Mammals have not been excluded from this winter's dire straits either. Rabbits have taken to eating bark from shrubs, and deer have been foraging throughout the day rather than appearing in early evening. Yet it is squirrel feeding that has captured the realization that lots of critters are really having to hustle for sustenance. A very wise outdoorsman, Joe Plum, had a good one the other day. He called to relate, "I've just seen something that I've never seen before in nature." While watching eagles in the tailwaters of Lake Red Rock Dam, squirrels were venturing out onto the ice to glean fish fins and scraps where an eagle had just plucked a fish apart. Squirrels were eating fish for protein. I've never seen that before. And I had to admit that that's a new one for me also. Later, another wise elder of the outdoor scene, Steve Pacheca, provided his anecdote that his squirrels had taken to eating the suet that he puts out for woodpeckers. Squirrels must be gleaning some protein similar to a walnut. I'm not sure if others are seeing wildlife activities like suet or fish-eating squirrels this harsh winter season, but please let us know at the station if you do. And lastly, there are reports of red-winged blackbirds singing in southern Iowa and sandhill cranes calling from the backwaters of the Mississippi River, and eagles are nesting, so surely spring will be at our doorsteps before we know it, or maybe just in the nick of time. Purple martins will be returning within 3 weeks, so it's time for spring-like conditions anytime soon. And that's our phenology today about hungry squirrels in Iowa. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. Become a member or find the donate button at our website, khoifm.org. This environmental update is sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, Story County's Conservation's Friends Group, working to enhance outdoor recreation, education, and conservation. Information can be found at www.oasco.org.
We have a live guest with us, one of the several that have tight schedules. So I would like to introduce Kiara Travisette. This is a busy week for climate activism, with ISU students organizing a major event to join the worldwide student climate strike at the Free Speech Zone in front of the Parks Library on campus from 11 to 2 on Friday. One of the student leaders from Ames High School is Kiara, and she's here to tell us how students in CAUSE at AHS are getting things started today. Hello, Kiara.
Hi.
What's going on today at Ames High?
So Ames High is going to be having its climate strike today. We will be walking out during third period, and we'll be out there for a single period with signs, and we'll be sitting there silently, just as Greta Thunberg did in front of the Swedish Parliament. And she's kind of been the sort of leader and inspiration for this worldwide strike on Friday. And the reason that we are not striking on Friday along with the international strike is because we don't have school on Friday. And we also do not have school tomorrow. And so we wanted to still be a part of this. So we decided to just do it a couple days early instead.
Then you can go to the strike on campus.
Yeah, that's an additional benefit.
So could you tell what the attitude of the administration is, for example, at Ames High when you go out today? Do they know about it?
Yes, they do know. We did just swing it by the administration, kind of with this attitude of, we are going to do this, what would be the consequences? Because this is an act of civil disobedience, of course. Thankfully, the administration is very supportive, and our principal, Mr. Evans, will be standing outside with us just to kind of supervise and make sure everything is going well. But they've been very supportive, actually, of the strike.
Well, you are part of a group that's been going for a while, CAUSE. What does that stand for, and what do you do?
CAUSE stands for Citizens Actualizing and Understanding Sustainable Environments. We do climate action within the community, especially on the school level. So some projects that we've worked on or that we're working on right now, for example, we're doing like a sweatshop simulation to raise awareness for like sweatshop labor and the environmental aspects of that. And we're working in conjunction with a couple other clubs at our school that work on social activism. We've done like some volunteering for Prudenterra, which does like sustainable landscaping. We did try to start up like a carpooling app, but that was kind of a little much for us as just high schoolers. But we just take on all sorts of projects like that.
The carpooling app really interests me because I have watch the evolution of more and more and more cars and more dependency on cars and all at all levels, from driving kids to grade school to when my kids were in middle school and in high school, they always biked to school. And I was recently told, oh, no, we don't need the bike racks because they're not. Now, you must have quite a few students at Ames High who bike.
Yeah, but a majority drive, and I mean, that's a concern for the environment, but it's also just the parking lot is absolutely chaotic, so CAUSE wanted to kind of take on the issue of the stuffed parking lot as well. But we just have no programming experience, so hopefully sometime long in the future we'll have someone come in that is actually knowledgeable with programming if we can maybe get that started up.
Well, of course, you're getting a lot of not exactly on-the-job training, but training for your future activities, right?
I would think so, yeah.
Well, the sustainable clothing sounds interesting to me. My only idea of sustainable clothing is going to a consignment shop.
That is an example of sustainable clothing, actually.
Well, now, what are you wearing today? Are you wearing something sustainable?
Yes, actually. So I am wearing some jeans from Everlane, which is a brand that focuses on making sustainably made and ethically made clothing. So they do outsource their their work to China, but they make sure that their workers there are being paid a living wage and that they're being given like all the sorts of benefits that they should and that they're working in safe working conditions. And their clothing, these jeans that I'm wearing, they were made using much less water than traditional jeans. And the denim byproducts that are created when these jeans were created are used to then create like bricks for sustainable housing. So it's actually a pretty cool brand. And their clothes is really fashionable. I do like clothing a lot and fashion. So you definitely don't have to sacrifice fashion for sustainability when it comes to clothing.
Well, you said something that really puzzled me. You said less water. And how do you use water to make jeans?
It has to do something with the dyeing process. So clothing is just really intensive to make. I mean, there's a lot of – I mean, if you think about the amount of cotton it would take to make a T-shirt, it's a lot of cotton. That's a lot of water that goes into planting that cotton. And often a lot of pesticides are used on that cotton, which is not good for the farmers who are planting it. And it actually puts the farmers in debt, so it's not even good for them, like, economically. And so – there's like environmental issues, there's like social issues as well, and buying sustainable clothing kind of tackles all of that, which is kind of cool.
And all of that by this group that, and for those of our listeners who didn't hear Lucas Bliley in January when he was talking about the petition that COSE had collected. Tell us about that petition, Chiara.
Yeah, so we started a petition for students at Ames High to sign to urge the school board and the city council to put together a climate action plan. And the reasoning behind doing that was because at a Ames Climate Action Team meeting, that's a community group, we were discussing how we needed like a lot of people to show up at the city council to show their support for like a climate plan. But and also that youth voices are especially important. The city council especially cares about hearing the voices of the youth, which makes sense. I mean, we're the ones that are going to be living in the city for quite a while. So with that in mind, we decided to have a petition and host a signature drive at the high school so that we could show that there was a lot of youth support, a lot of student support for a climate action plan. And we actually got, I want to say, 613 signatures, which was really, really encouraging. And we presented it both to the city council and the school board. And both groups were quite supportive of it, which was also very encouraging. I know the city council is now, they've allotted money to do, I believe, a greenhouse gas inventory, which is the first step to a climate action plan. Yeah. So, yeah.
No, well, actually, it looks to me like Irv Kloss just walked in, and so he could talk about, I think he's been talking to the council people, so we'll find
absolutely.
Out whether you've gotten some results from your petition.
That'd be great.
Okay. So let's invite Irv in, okay, well, Chiara, while you're still on mic, but let's find out a little bit more. Are you going to be involved in the Climate March activities on Friday that the university's doing?
Yes, I will be. I will be at that event. I'm looking forward to seeing what that will look like exactly. So, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to that.
And do you expect there will be some other Ames High students there also?
Yes. I know for sure that Lucas will be there, Lucas Bliley. He's also a leader of COSE. And I'm sure we'll see a few others as well.
Well, except for the 613 students that signed your petition, how many members of COSE are there?
I would say there's about five of us that come pretty regularly. We've got a few other members that come occasionally. And it's a great group. I have to say it's one of my favorite clubs, just because the people in that group are very dedicated and they want to do something and they want to change the world just a little bit. So it's a great group to work with.
Irv Kloss is here now, and
for those who don't know Dr. Kloss, he is an ISU Professor Emeritus of Animal Ecology. In his retirement, he has been Soil and Water Commissioner for Storey County, and in Ames is best known for leading the campaign to develop the former Hallett's Quarry to Ada Hayden Heritage Park. Glad you could join us, Irv.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. So you've been talking to the City Council, is that right?
Well, yes, a lot of us have, actually, and I think they are listening and aware that we're trying to make them more aware that climate change is a crisis, and that really a lot of cities have mobilized to the point of calling it a crisis and starting to have or take action, actually, of reducing their CO2 emissions and also to find a way to remove atmospheric carbon dioxide from the air.
Well, I suppose that involves things like building code.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, we hear a lot about the fact that, oh, we can't afford that, or the climate change is too expensive, we can't do anything. But if we don't do something mitigate what's going on, the costs will be so much greater. That's what we're trying to see our cities take action to avoid. And a lot of people think, well, we should do this at the national level, or at least the state level. What can a city do? Because we're such a small entity when you compare it with the entire nation or the world. But if a number of cities began to mobilize and do things, I think it would spread because there's a lot of awareness now. In fact, polls that have been taken by Yale University have shown that 70% of the people in this country believe that climate is a serious problem. And it's time to mobilize, folks.
Well, I guess that we're seeing some action here in Ames already. I guess actually this has been underway for some time because of the solar farm, which I believe you worked on developing. I mean, the concept, right?
Well, I was one of many, I think, that began to think about what Ames could do. And then when Cedar Falls found a great response from their local folks, and they built they started with a one megawatt solar farm, and the demand was so great for selling these panels that they enlarged it to a 1.5 megawatt, and they did this in a matter of months. I don't know exactly how long it took them to get all those panels sold, the solar panels. But Ames seems to be having trouble with getting people to buy into this.
And that's exactly why in just a few minutes Don Kalm is coming in. He's actually coming in between two staff meetings. when I said, you know, we need you at KHOI to try to, you know, promote the sale of the solar packs, he said, you know, the staff meetings can wait. I'm coming. So, so he can talk about the status of that. But ours will be comparable to the size of the one in Cedar Rapids, right?
Right. And we need folks to step up and make an investment in the future, and also to save the money of themselves, because they would get a rebate on their electric bill from the electricity that would be generated. And he'll tell you about this. I wanted to mention the meeting that's being held today at the Memorial Union, the Iowa State Memorial Union. The city has been is in the process of developing a comprehensive plan. And they started this about a month ago with the meetings of the community, and people can make input at what they feel should be done with the new plan. I walked into City Hall a while back, and here was a big poster that says, "What will Ames look like in 2040? Well, nobody knows, but you can imagine a few things if we did something, if we took action on climate. For example, everybody will be driving electric cars. I'm convinced that that's going to happen anyway. But in order to accommodate electric cars, we need charging stations, and we need a lot more. We've got a couple in this city now. We need fast chargers, as they call them, because people can't wait a long time to charge up their car, but they're willing to wait 15 minutes or so. And anyway, what would happen if the university would build canopies over the big parking lots at the football stadium and the Hilton Coliseum, and put solar panels on the top of those, and then have charging stations beneath them so that when people come to events, they can plug in their electric cars and get charged up. So that's one thing. I could also envision that we will have a circle of wind turbines that would be providing electricity and renewable electricity to the city, or all around the city. In other words, there would be a belt of turbines and possibly solar farms that would be bringing us electricity from renewable sources. The sun is doesn't cost us anything if we can utilize that. Farmers would have converted everything to no-till and cover crops, and sequestering carbon from the the atmosphere into the soil. We would be planting trees and increasing our density of our urban forest. Everybody would be composting their food waste. We would be have gardens. Everybody would be have a backyard garden. And there would be also others that would have greenhouses that have larger land that they can afford to put greenhouses on to provide us with food so that we don't have to transport it all the way from California and even South America. There could be aqua facilities where fish would be growing. I mean, there's so many things that could be done, and it would provide jobs, would provide a boost to the economy, and yet we're not thinking in those terms. We're thinking of more of the same. And so if you have time, from 11 to 3, I believe it is, at Memorial Union today in the Pioneer Room, go and express your thoughts. The city will listen to those comments that are taken, and if we have enough comments, it will make an impact.
Well, and speaking of the comments, the survey that is that the survey that's also presented at the what is it called? Not sip and share, snack and share. This is like the open houses the city had last
week
or so.
Yes, right. And this is to make it convenient for university students and faculty to go and voice their concerns or their ideas.
Yes.
And, it's called Snack and Share, and it'll be in the Pioneer Room of the Memorial Union today. And the survey that is being done also online, you can go to the city website and take this survey. It only takes about 10 minutes to do and express some ideas there.
No, so. I have the other side of that because it takes 10 minutes or more, and I couldn't finish mine in time, so I have to go back and start over. But so people should allow enough time to really have their thoughts in ahead of them when they.
Yeah, this is a process. You know, I was made input back in the 90s when we built the development of the land use policy plan that the city, and this is actually the comprehensive plan is actually being done because the various members of the community noticed that this land use policy plan was out of date. It had been changed a number of times, and we needed to update it. So that's one of the purposes of the comprehensive plan.
Well, there's a lot to talk about there, and I am delighted to hear that there are a lot of people thinking about this, and that you're having some good conversations now. You've been talking especially with the consulting firm that is working with the city, right?
And the consulting firm is called RDG. It's a firm out of Des Moines, and they have very excellent reputation, and I believe they'll do a great job. It's they have also developed climate plans for cities. And they've been conducting various forums and conferences that they have promoted or been a part of. And so they're going to do a good job. It's just that we have to let the city know that what RGG can do.
Besides filling out the survey, what can people do that will be influential?
Be involved with this process, because this early process of input that people are making is the first step, and more will be developed over the next 18 months or so. Be watchful of it. Go and comment at city council meetings and attempt to express yourself, because that's the only way that the city can respond to it.
Yes, and I just talked to a city council person the other day who said, what's our agenda? Come when climate is on the agenda, don't just come randomly.
Right.
So
right. You have to be watchful, and you can do that by online with the city council's website, and then just be knowledgeable of the meetings that are being held.
One way to keep up on things that you can do to move Ames toward the goal of carbon neutrality would be to join Irv and Kiara in the Ames Climate Action Team. Irv, could you tell people how they could join or at least get reminders of city council meetings and other actions or events?
It's very easy. We meet the second Monday of the month at the Unitarian Fellowship on Highland Avenue. It's open to everybody. Just come and make yourself known. Sign up with an email address so that we can send you notices of things that are going on. And that's all there is to it. There's no membership due or anything like that.
There are several churches that are involved.
Yes. We started this as a social action movement. We feel that climate has an impact on people at the margins. And so social justice is a big part of solving climate because a lot of people are going to be affected who had nothing to do with causing climate change. I think every faith-based organization should take notice that this is an important issue and that social justice is part of it.
Well, thank you.
One of the most immediate actions that citizens and organizations can do in Ames is to take part in SunSmart Ames. And Don Com, director of Ames Electric, just came in between staff meetings to give you an update on it. Welcome, Don.
So we have a community solar farm called SunSmart Ames. We're looking at building it down near Sam's Club on Airport Road by the airport. It's one of those projects where people can opt in and be part of the project. Currently, right now, we're at about 63%. And just in the last few days, we've had several churches come to us saying they would like to buy 100 power packs. A second church came to us yesterday on Monday and said they'd actually want to buy 240 power packs. So things are really moving in a positive direction where a lot of people are opting into the project.
Well, what about businesses? Wasn't it the hope that businesses that use so much power would see the advantage of that?
There are several businesses that are talking to us. The model that we have set up right now is where people are purchasing their power packs up front, and then they get the power over the next 20 years. And that's a model where businesses look at it and say, well, I want paybacks in a year or a year or two. And so we're trying to restructure some unique opportunities to where we can help them look at other positive aspects of being part of the project, like marketing. You know, can we put up a sign that will list their logo so that people could see just how interested they are in green and renewable energy?
I would think that would be actually a big selling point for the town if we had a good climate action plan and we were a green city, that we would be attracting more businesses and maybe residents even.
Oh, I think so. As we continue to move along this dynamic, as we move from fossil fuels into more and more green renewable resources, I think a lot more businesses are going to look at Ames and say, that's the place where I want to be.
Well, is there anything else to say about how close are we to reaching our goal?
Well, the goal right now that I have with the city council is we're trying to get to 80%. So we're at about 63% now, so we're not quite there yet. Even with that said, I think if we start building a project like this, more and more people will get excited about it. They'll see something happening, and we'll see another wave of people wanting to be part of the project. And we'll jump in. And I'm hoping that this is the first project of many. So once we get this project done, we're going to start another solar project. And we're going to keep doing this as long as there's interest from our customers to invest in green and renewable resources.
Now, can you start building even if you don't quite get to 80%?
So what will happen is in talking with the council, Anything that is not completely spoken for, I guess what I would like to do is have the utility or have the city pick up those non-spoken for portions of it, and then we would roll it into our own generation mix. And then as more and more people come on board, we'll have the ability then to sell them and provide those to ongoing people that want more solar.
Well, what about the new Ames High School?
I have been talking to the Ames High School. They work under some unique dynamics. For them to invest capital, it's my understanding that that money has to be spent on site and put it at the school. We are looking at other models that maybe be possible for them to be part of the project. But I think right now it's tough for them in a constrained financial market where they're trying to build a new high school, and so they've got a lot of costs that they're looking at. So we continue to talk to them. Not sure if we can get to a point where they have the capability to invest in SunSmart at this point in time.
Is it possible for Ames High Foundation to do that?
That's actually an excellent idea, and this reminds me of what's being done with many of the churches in the area, where people will donate money themselves to their church and say, I want to buy a power pack on behalf of my church, and then that pays for electricity for the next 20 years. Ames High Foundation could do the exact same thing, where they purchase power packs on behalf of the school district, on behalf of the high school. That would be an excellent way of bringing solar energy to the high school.
Well, it sounds like one way or the other, we're going to have a solar city.
Very much so. I'm looking forward to having a project up and running.
And more to come.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in on this very busy day to tell us about SunSmart Ames.
That's it.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Sunshine on my shoulders makes me happy. Sunshine in my eyes can make me cry. Sunshine on the water looks so lovely. Sunshine almost always makes me high. If I had a day that I could give you, I'd give to you a day just like today. If I had a song that I could sing for you, I'd sing a song to make you feel this way. Sunshine on my shoulders makes me happy. Sunshine in my eyes can make me cry. The water looks so lovely. Sunshine. almost always makes me high.
Is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa and sometimes beyond, as you will find with our next guest. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen. During the first half of the program, we discussed climate change and some of the things that Ames will be doing to address it, including making use of the sun's energy for electricity. Our next guest comes from his annual winter trip to a sunnier region, but he doesn't go there for the weather. Welcome to Dan Bean, who lives on a farm east of Marshalltown, but brings us stories from a refugee camp in Zimbabwe. Thanks for coming to Ames this morning to bring us a vision of a different world.
Thank you, Susan. I'm really happy to be here.
Good. Thanks. And so how did you first travel to Africa?
I first went to Africa, I think it was 55 years ago. I was teaching school in Kenya. I was 3 years teaching vocational agriculture in a high school there.
Was this part of the Peace Corps or something else?
No, I was registered with the draft board as a conscientious objector, and so I was fulfilling my obligations for alternative service.
And why was teaching agriculture in Africa alternative service?
Well, alternative service has to be something that's done in for the good of the country, and I think they felt that building relationships with other nations was something positive for the United States.
And so this did this predate the Peace Corps? I'm trying to remember from that.
About the same time, I think Peace Corps had gotten started 3 or 4 years before I went, but I was not really affiliated with Peace Corps. I was with Columbia University had a program that I was working with.
Well, so that's a long, long time ago. You haven't been going back regularly since then, have you?
I've been back probably 20 or 25 times to Kenya. I've been going quite often, yes.
Oh, well, always to Kenya or?
Most of my work has been in Kenya. I've worked in Tanzania and most recently down in Zimbabwe as well, yes.
So, well, now, I believe your son had something to do with your current...
Yes. My son is a principal of a Christian school in Nova Scotia, and one of his goals is that every student will have the opportunity to do a service project in a developing country. So he was interested in getting his students into the refugee camps in Africa, and he asked me to go and investigate a couple refugee camps, the Kakuma camp in northwest Kenya and the Tongagora camp down in Zimbabwe. And I always said, I'm happy for an excuse to go to Africa.
So well, it doesn't sound to me like refugee camps would be particularly enjoyable places to visit.
It doesn't sound like it. I'll confess I do enjoy going to the refugee camps because I like relating to the people. I like hearing their stories. I like trying to understand why they fled from their countries of origin and what their life is like in the camp and what they see in their future.
Well, you mentioned the religious that – your son was teaching in a Christian school. I heard you say in our conversation something about the Mennonites. Now, Mennonites are a historic peace church, like the Quakers. Isn't that right?
Right, yes. My son had served for 7 years down in Bolivia with the Mennonite Central Committee. It's sort of how we've made a connection with the Mennonites, yes.
Oh, so that wasn't when you had your alternative service.
No.
It wasn't as a Mennonite.
No, actually, I'm a Quaker.
Okay. What was interesting to me when you told me about the refugee camp, who administers the refugee camps?
there are sort of two levels of administration in the refugee camps. In Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe government has a representative there who actually administers the camp. But the funding comes from the United Nations through the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And the thing that surprised me was that there really are no United Nations employees in the refugee camps, but the work is all done by various NGOs. For example, there's a group called Terra di Home Italia, an Italian organization that does the primary schools and the preschool and the health clinics. The Jesuit Refugee Services furnishes the secondary education. There's an organization called GOAL that furnishes the water and the various programs to generate income for the refugees, such as some crop production and livestock production. So the actual work in the camp then is done by these different NGOs, and the funding then comes through the United Nations.
Well, I guess what interested me was your story about your hosts seemed to be Jesuits, and I thought that was interesting because you don't hear so much about the Jesuits anymore, and certainly not in context of working with other groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a small group working for the Jesuit Refugee Service in Tongagora, but Jesuit Refugee Services are involved in many different refugee camps around the world and have a fairly large presence in these camps. Personally, I'd never been associated with them before either, but it was the group that my son had made initial contact with, and they were delightful hosts while I was in the camp.
Now, you said what you enjoyed was hearing the people's stories, talking to the people. It sounds like these camps are not just temporary until people get resettled someplace else.
I always had the vision that people were in the camps for a matter of weeks or months or maybe a year until things settled down and they went back home again. I've talked to a lot of people in the Tongagora camp who've been there 15 and 20 years, and it sounds like they might be there forever. In Tongagora camp in Zimbabwe, the majority of the people come from the DRC, which is the Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC is the largest country in Africa and quite rich in minerals, copper and gold and diamonds and other important metals for us. And a lot of conflicts have arisen in the DRC over control of these resources. It's sort of been continual civil war there since independence in 1960. And so a lot of people are displaced by these wars that go on. The people that are in the camp have seen a lot of atrocities in their lifetime back in the DRC. Every one of them told me, I'm never going back there again. So they're either trying to get resettled in some other country or maybe integrated into the Zimbabwe economy.
And can the Zimbabwe economy handle these people?
Zimbabwe right now is a basket case economically. I'm told that there's something over 80% unemployment just among the Zimbabwe population, which makes it sort of problematic for refugees to be integrated into the economy. At the same time, some of the refugees are leaving the camp, going to the capital city and trying to survive there, running small shops or some way just to eke out a living.
Now, you said you had some stories. So what are some of these refugee stories?
There's been two or three interesting ones I can relate to you. I met a man named Rashidi who came from the DRC. He was a doctor, an anesthesiologist, and he'd worked for several years in the DRC. He'd worked for Doctors Without Borders, and he'd worked in private clinics. In the last clinic he was working in, which was not too far from the Rwanda border, and incidentally, most of the problems in the DRC seem to occur in the eastern part of the country, not too far from Rwanda. So he was working in this clinic, and one of the rebel groups overran the town he was in. They came to the clinic and told the doctors they were going to work for them now. The doctors sort of said, well, they didn't really want to do that, so they just promptly shot half of them dead. Rashidi was locked into a small room in the clinic while they went away and the rebels went away and did some other things. He knocked a hole in the ceiling and escaped and ran to his house and collected his documents and some money and his family, and they ran. They went about 20 miles down the road to another town and tried to stop there. The people found out they'd come from this town that had been overrun by the rebels. They accused them of being part of the rebel group and threatened them again. He kept running and eventually ended up in the refugee camp in Tongogara. Rashidi is an interesting case. The refugee camp is quite hot. And after 3 or 4 years in the refugee camp, his wife and his family went to the capital city about 8 hours away, where they rented a small room and they put the children in school there. His wife sells a few things on the side of the road to make a little income. Rashidi stayed in the camp because he had responsibilities with the church, and he also was supporting some orphans who were either relatives or friends. He has made progress on resettlement in the United States. There's a portion of the State Department called the Refugee Resettlement Organization that handles that, and he's made the first two steps. He has a case number now. I suspect he and his family might be in the States within a couple years. So it's been a rough time for him.
But obviously he has a very high level of skill. What are some of the other stories?
I knew a woman named Emanuela who came out of the DRC. There's a lot of lawlessness in the country because the government just isn't able to function with these constant wars. And in that lawlessness, you get a lot of bandits preying on people. So about 10 years ago, her husband was killed by a group of bandits. And somewhere in that intervening time, she was befriended by a man from Belgium who was working in the country, a white man. And he was paying the school fees for her children. So the people assumed that when a white man is involved that there's money there. And the people said, well, this friend of yours is giving you a lot of money. We want some of that money. So they attacked her in the night and cut her up badly with machetes and left her for dead on the road. She got to the hospital and recovered and immediately fled to the refugee camp. She was in the refugee camp a while, and after a couple of years, she made her way to Rwanda, where some of her children were, and I'm hoping that she'll be able to remain there. But it's for a single woman in the refugee camps, it can be quite daunting as well.
You mentioned that they had plots where they could grow things. Mm-hmm. So are some of the women farmers?
They tried to make the refugees as self-sufficient as they can. So there's a 200-acre irrigated field adjacent to the camp that they've divided up into plots of land for 800 different families. They grow three crops a year there. The United Nations furnishes the seed and the fertilizer and any chemicals they need for those crops. And people can either eat the crops or they can sell them. One of the organizations works with them on a little bit of livestock production as well. I should mention that up until this year, the United Nations had a food distribution once a month in the camp when people would line up and be distributed food based on the number of family members they had. About 6 months ago, they changed that program to where they're now distributing money to the refugees and allowing them to buy food in the camp or within the community. I think it's an effort to sort of sustain the local economy as well. So they're given $13 per month for each member of the family. $13 doesn't sound like very much to live on for a month, so I think it's pretty tight for the families, but somehow they manage.
Well, that's very interesting. So what do you do when you go there?
When I go to the camp, I visit the schools. I walk around the streets. I meet different people. I try to go to their homes and visit with them about where they came from, why they fled, how long they've been here, what their hopes are for the future. Just trying to relate to them and be a presence, say, you know, I care about your condition. I'm here to listen to your story.
But no practical aid, just...
I'm not there to bring anything in the way of material goods or money to them. Both the staff and the staff members and the refugees feel quite isolated in these camps, like maybe the world has forgotten that they're there. So both of those groups of people, the staff members and the refugees, have said to me, you know, we just appreciate your coming and listening to our stories.
Do you have any concluding remarks?
I think some people are not aware of how many refugee camps there are in the world. There's about 200 refugee camps recognized by the United Nations in 128 different countries. The largest refugee camp is in Bangladesh now for the Rohingya refugees from Myanmar, about 900,000 people in that camp. The second largest camp is the Bidi Bidi camp in Uganda with about 300,000 people from the South Sudan. Dadaab camp is the third largest with about 290,000 people from Somalia and Sudan and different places. Kakuma with almost 200,000. These are large numbers of refugees in the world. And so it's a big issue that we're glad that there's a United Nations there to help support these people.
These sound like they'd be pretty good-sized cities. Do they have they're just organized by the NGOs?
The host country sort of designates where the camp is going to be and what its size is going to be. And then the United Nations furnishes the funds and sort of sets out the rules, and then these different NGOs administer the programs, the water distribution, the food, the education, the health care, and special programs for, say, vulnerable women and children, special programs for people with special health needs, and try to meet the refugees' needs in those ways.
Well, that is a very interesting way to see the world through the eyes of an Iowa farmer.
It does seem a bit out of character for a farmer, doesn't it?
Well, thank you very much.
We've just been talking with Dan Bean, who farms near Marshalltown and has been telling us about his experiences in Africa. Before we close the show, I have an announcement from Pat Schlarbaum about something that's happening today.
At the Ames Public Library tonight, Wednesday, March 13th at 7 to 8 p.m., there will be a presentation sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County called Floral Jewels of the Tallgrass Prairies and Other Ecosystems. And they are recognized by their vegetation. Many types of tallgrass prairie communities can be observed in Iowa depending on moisture and fertility, how much disturbance there has been, and biogeography. The role of forbs in many prairies of Iowa will be presented by Dr. Tom Rosberg this evening at 7 p.m. at the Ames Public Library. So there's a lot going on today. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today. Other voices you heard were Kiara Travisette, Dan Bean, and Pat Schlarbaum, and Irv Kloss. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Sunshine on My Shoulders by John Denver from the CD, The Essential John Denver. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878, or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership. Just look for the yellow donate button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is provided in part by the Iowa State Center, presenting the San Francisco Symphony, widely considered to be among the most artistically adventurous and innovative arts institutions in the U.S., March 29th at 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.